From the boardroom to the locker room, sport captures the imagination like little else. In this podcast, we talk to the men and women who make the big decisions and those who make the big plays to find out where sport is and, importantly, where it's going. But we do so through the only eyes that matter, those of the fan. Well, welcome everybody to another edition. I'm going to keep calling it Are You Not Quarantined for the time being, because I think most people are.
Yeah.
It is, what the hell day is it, Rog? March the 29th, we're recording this.
29th, yeah.
I'm in the Cayman Islands. Rog, I presume you're in, at, on, under, near, by the lake somewhere?
Yeah, there's no surprises anymore, mate, yeah.
Yeah, and Jars, are you off your sick bed?
Yeah, I'm fine, I'm back, and I went for a long walk on Wimbledon Common today. To do my hours exercise, so I saw the great and the good out on in Southwest London.
I'm not sure that dogging counts as government mandated exercise, but good. I'm glad. Nice of you to get out of the house again.
Well, there were some seagulls around as well.
Excellent, excellent. Well, here we are, gents, in a brave new world. You know, there's still plenty to talk about, but nothing live and nothing actually has changed in the world of sport except in the boardroom level, and I'm sure there's plenty to talk about there. Rog, what have you seen this week that's caught your eye?
Well, a couple of things I would start off with. The first one, I got through the whole of the documentary, The Test.
Good.
Which I was just blown away with. And it's an interesting one, Grant, because at the start, when I didn't know any of these players, because I'm not a super big cricket fan these days, I was struggling a little bit, but two episodes, then three, four, and then when it came to the Ashes, it felt as if I was part of that group, you know, young men, all with hopes and fears and dreams, you know, spending a summer together, bonding, and obviously the coach, Justin Langer. And, you know, I just thought at the end of it, it struck me a little bit like Chariots of Fire. You know, I just loved it. I can't say it highly enough.
Yeah, well, I mean, I did tell you to watch it. I knew you'd enjoy it. I'm surprised you struggled to get into it because I was kind of hooked right away. But what do you think these sort of fly-on-the-wall docu-series, and it's not just a one-off documentary, so they really do, with all these shows now, have time for the characters to unfold, for time for the fans to get into their lives. Do you think, given the widespread nature of Netflix and Amazon Prime now and the places that these documentaries are going, do you think this type of filmmaking is going to change fans' perceptions of players, fans' relationship with players? Because to your point, you know, when I watched the first one of these, I saw was the Man City one. And, you know, I wasn't pro or anti Man City. I didn't feel like they were a true football team because of all the money that's been poured in and buying the best players. But once you got to know the players, as you said, they're just a good bunch of young men with hopes and dreams and trying to win things and becoming a team and becoming friends and teammates. I mean, and it completely changed my perception of that team. Does this, you think, change the macro perspective of fan and player?
Well, I'll go first and then Giles can give a more professional view of it, but I think that it's like everything in life. You get a new character, a new category. For example, like the animation films that came out around Toy Story and things like that, and then you get too many of them, and then it whittles out, and you again see what's good and what's not good. And I think that's the case also with these. You know, I think some of them haven't worked. I don't think Juventus worked. I don't think Sergio Ramos worked. So there's good content and bad content, regardless of whether it's a docu-series or not. What I think is a theme, and it's been something that I've been banging on about for two years now on this place, is that sport really needs to work hard on getting the fans bought into the protagonists. You know, and my own experience here was exactly that. For two episodes, I didn't know who was a batter, who was a bowler, and I just was relatively cold. I knew Justin Langer, but by the end of it, I knew them all. And so it's a horrible cliche, but it is really storytelling. And I think there's some people that tell stories well and some that don't. And this one for me was a wonderful story.
Giles, what did you make? I'm assuming you've seen it. Maybe you haven't.
I think what's interesting from my perspective, I've been thinking a lot about and worrying, like we all have, about the world that we live in and all of the effects that COVID-19 is having. And one of the things that I feel is beginning to happen, I just watched something that some of the golfers sent out, McIlroy and Thomas Bjorn, about who the real heroes are. And it's talking about the heroes being the doctors and nurses and health workers around the world. And there's something happening, and I hope it lingers and lasts well beyond this crisis, where the role of sport is to provide us, yes, with entertainment and great joy and great fandom, but also a connection with our heroes that used to be the case, you know, the local football team, the local rugby team, cricket team, whatever it may be, that somehow has got lost in the sense of the commercial world has taken our heroes into a pantheon so much above the real world that you can't get close to them. And something is happening in the world which is far bigger than sport, which is, you know, whether every night it's people in France or Italy or Spain clapping the health service or whatever it may be, is you're seeing a humanity of real people helping real people. And sport is no different, because sport should be there to serve people, not to dictate for people. And there's something that is beginning to happen, which is suddenly the nonsense of overpaid premiership footballers or golfers or whatever it may be, is they're just flesh and blood and they're there to provide a service. And because that service is gone now, because of what's happened, is one, we're missing it and we're all wondering what that's going to mean for the future. But I think it also brings everybody down to earth and brings everyone down to a level. And this reset that we talk about in industry and commercial world anyway, I hope there'll be an attitudinal reset, which is, yes, we admire our heroes, but we don't put them on these stupid pantheon places that the commercial world has done over the last 30 years, because it suddenly feels kind of bonkers. I don't know. That's just a Wimbledon common ramble thought I had.
I think that's correct, Giles. I would go further and say that I'm really looking at these days at who I think is maybe deliberately or just authentically scoring points that will have a return for many years for them, and who isn't. You know, I would give a couple of examples. I think Liverpool football team, in this moment where everybody's talking about what's going to happen, I haven't seen anything from them about lobbying for we must be champions, this mustn't be called null and void. You know, the only videos I see coming out of Liverpool are ones that are showing support for the workers and the health service and the police and things like that. I think Klopp has always been very, very smart in the media, and he continues to do that. But Liverpool as a club, I think, are showing a credible dignity. At least I haven't seen anything from them saying, you know, we need to be crowned champions. Juventus yesterday, Juventus players decided to take significant wage cuts that will save their club 90 million, I think, over the next 3 or 4 months. Whereas other clubs are threatening this and it's all getting very, very antagonistic. They got their players together and worked it out, so they all come out on the right side. And then, of course, you can't say anything without the chap who has become the PE teacher of the UK every morning. I'm not in the UK, so I'm not familiar with his name. I think it's Wicks or something like that. He's given all the money that he's generating on YouTube now, which is not insignificant, is giving it to the health service. And you're right, Giles. I think, you know, it's very easy for us to think this is cheesy and one of those moments that everybody feels lovely and then you go back to your cynical world. But you get a sense that people's value dial has significantly changed in the last 2 or 3 weeks.
Well, if you look at this on a bigger scale. I mean, if you look at a world that has been pushed more and more towards globalization, right? The global village, we're all one world now. What you're simply seeing, I think, is just the retracement of that. It began at a geopolitical level. It began with you know, Trump withdrawing from the Middle East and America becoming more and more isolated. We had trade wars. We had all these things that were chipping away at a world that has, for the last two decades, been pushing really hard towards globalization. And you've seen it in the politics. You've seen it in the politics of what have been called far right and nationalist parties, Brexit, all these things. This is a similar dynamic to that, Rog. This is people withdrawing and wanting to be part of their own community and invest in their own community. The downside of it, I suspect, and I agree with everything you've both said about what's going to happen on a sort of family and a town and a country level, the downside of that is on the back end of it, in which case outsiders, in quotation marks, are not welcome because you do retreat. And there is an argument to be made that it becomes more tribal. Whether it's football fans, whatever, people right now are feeling the need to sort of nail their flag to a familiar mast and a local mast and become part of a group, which is understandable in isolation. When everyone's isolated, you want to be part of a group, and it works at a family level, it works at a town level, and we're seeing it work on a country level. I mean, the place you're not seeing it work on a country level at the moment is the US, because obviously you've got 50 disparate states all with their own kind of policy on this. But I definitely can see what you're both saying, but I don't think this is without negative consequences outside that little bubble that we're talking about.
Yeah, and it's funny. I'm going to keep going back to Wimbledon Common because I was walking on it. One of the things...
Until you get caught.
I was trying to find a womble. One of the things that's really irritating me, and this is where I sense we're living, obviously, in this world of genuine fear, and it's an unease that we all feel, is that if you go for a walk, normally you might say good morning to people. And more often than not, people are not only distancing themselves physically, like keeping 2 meters apart, but people are keeping their head down. They're not holding eye contact. And I made a decision today, which is, I'm in my sort of large bonhomie way, I'm bellowing good morning to everybody or good afternoon, which is, we don't need to stop this sense of community or fear is fear, but one can at least be friendly. And it's amazing. So I tried this experiment this morning, wandering around saying good morning to people as I went past. And most people were almost shook themselves out of their kind of bubble, looked you in the eye and went, oh, good morning. And there was a change. And the reason I think this is appropriate to sport is in the new world order, and it, I think we're all agreed it will be a new world order, whatever that may be, is the importance of sport to reconnect communities and or people and connections in a positive way, in the way that I'm a bit of a disciple of Simon Barnes, the former Times correspondent, as you both know, is... The reason sport matters is because it doesn't matter. That's his argument. It's there because it's not war. It's there because it's not COVID-19. It's there because it's not about anything other than it's something to delight us and something to provide our lives with some meaning. So that's what I want to see the new world order of sport being, is a happier, as it's going to say, it sounds so trite this, but happier sport, the less sort of... angry that there are so many people in the sports industry who've got egos the size of France, and they're angry about success and they're angry about how everything should be, rather than just taking the joy of what sport is, which is binary confrontation in a non-important way, whether it be on a taekwondo or football, doesn't matter, and where we just love the joy of competition. And that's what I would love to see.
Well, maybe it is a moment where we've all lived, especially you and I, Giles, this move towards the globalization of sport that Grant talked about, where, you know, you've got people who never visit Old Trafford that claim passion for the club sitting in Bangkok, where Dugout will tell you that the average fan these days supports 7 clubs. And we've all kind of got on that train and talked about how do we monetize this global audience. I actually think Grant's point about going back into our villages and tribes, that's not necessarily a bad thing if it can be managed properly, because that was a time when in English football, you had Derby, Nottingham, Aston Villa, all winning and then going on to success in Europe, and same in other countries. And I think that my hope is that we kind of go away from money driving how our sport will be structured going forward. And we actually start and saying, well, what's the most authentic way to do it? What's the way that makes everybody feel engaged? And what's the way to stop this awful word polarization? And, you know, we all suspect that once this blows over, money will drive everything that it always, as it always has done in life. But I want to take this moment and think that people will hold on to this optimism that they've got, that, you know, you do want your team to still have maybe at least half the players that came up through the local community and are pulling on the jersey. And, you know, I remember the days when clubs had maximum three foreigners, whether that was in the UK or certainly in Italy. And it worked fine, you know, because it had the identity. So I that would be my hope. I was on a couple of these remote conferences that Sport organised this week. One was Leader in Sport with James Emmett, and they did a wonderful 28-person Zoom call. The technology was wonderful. And I did another one with Sports Techie where same kind of thing. And what I just listened really more than anything. What I heard was that, you know, no matter how much we think we're saying, oh, this is big, is bigger than we think, that this disruption here. You know, live sport has been the glue that has kept pay TV channels together, because you can't substitute live sport. It's not like a movie. It's not like a series or a docu-series. And it's now not there. And the advertising dollars that follow that are not there, which means that everybody's having to rethink. And there's a lot of people in every industry, not just sport, that are not great when you have to, you know, think outside the box. Both of those reasons, I'm in an excited place as we speak tonight. I think we're going to get away from this money-driven attitude of sport. And I think this is the best moment ever for people that have got a little bit of a, you know, let's see what I can do in this uncertain world. And you know, I'm in a good place, guys.
Oh, I hope you're right, Roger. And I can see how it could go that way. I worry about the length of memory that people have, and I worry about just how hard the commercial interests are going to be trying to create the kind of content that brings us back to where we were pre-virus, because without it, they're dead, as you said. I think maybe this hastens the arrival of, you know, Premflix, for want of a better name for it. I think it would make perfect sense now for institutions like the Premier League to set up their own streaming service and say to people, well, you know, you don't need Sky TV, because you're right, without sport, they're screwed. And if the Premier League decides to call force majeure and move into their own world, I think it would be a very easy thing to do and a very straightforward thing to do. But there's going to be a period where everything, and I mean everything, every resource that the commercial world has is going to be thrown at trying to recreate where we were before this virus. And my fear is that could win, because people are so starved and so desperate to have this back again that they will accept whatever is thrown at them. And if what's thrown at them is community clubs and smaller, they'd grab it. But I think we all know the chance of that happening is fairly small, I would argue.
Do you know, it's interesting as well. One of the things I've been thinking about, obviously with my old hat on in the sponsorship world, is I think there is the most amazing opportunity, which I wonder how many sponsors of large corporations will take up, which they've got the most extraordinary opportunity to take the thermometer, take the temperature that we're all living right now of society, and going, what is it that fans want? What do people want through sport? And they want the sense of community and belonging and all of those things that we know about sport and talk about all the time. And yet how many sponsors traditionally are incredibly aloof, don't engage at all, and have actually zero impact on most fans, and puts into question whether sponsorship is a valuable investment or not. And yet this is a time when the world is feeling both nervous, skittish, sensitive, and desperate for being embraced. For the good brands, for the brands who understand sponsorship, the next year could be absolutely game-changing for how they invest through sport to engage with real customers to sell their products, and as a result, increase and develop the income that comes in through into sport for the good of sport. And I, the optimist in me very much is hoping that there are going to be big corporations now go, how do we talk to fans? We didn't talk to them before. Let's put our arms around them and let's not look huge and kind of presidential and frightening, but let's get in amongst the people. And that may be something that the sports world will benefit from this reset, which is corporations looking to engage rather than to sit aloof.
But you, look, you guys understand that side of this world way better than I do, right? I mean, that's the beauty of my, you know, good fortune to be able to talk to you about this stuff. But for me, even if they do it that way, whichever way they go, for them, it's about the bottom line, right? It's about how do we generate profit from this? That's it. Pure and simple. They're not going to go out there and do things that cost them money, or they're likely to break even. Maybe they will do the break even thing initially. Maybe. I doubt it. But more than ever, these companies are going to have to find a way to generate profits. And so as soon as you, this is, you know, this is one of the big problems I have with sport and business, because their incentives are completely disaligned, right? The fans just want, they're in it for the game. They want victory, they want success, they want bragging rights over their neighbors, whatever it is, but it's a purely emotional connection to those teams. And the businesses are purely in it for the profit. And so, you know, Charlie Munger said, show me the incentives and I'll show you the outcomes. Yep. And it's true, because ultimately the corporate side of this cannot go back into sport as altruists. They can't. I mean, they might be able to do it initially, but it's not a long-term business product model.
Let me throw this out, especially to Giles, to reply to you, because I'm starting to see it a little bit already. Where I mentioned, you know, Liverpool and Klopp earlier, and the kind of kudos that is going to generate for whatever you want to call the brand, you know, whether it's the Klopp brand, whether it's Liverpool. What I'm seeing is that sponsors these days are starting to ask to be associated with functionality that's seen as innovative and seen as doing something to help the enjoyment of the fan. I'll give you an example. I'll give you two examples, actually. One is our own sponsor, Smart Sports, and Chris, who obviously when sports channels don't have any content these days, he's getting a lot of calls saying, what can you put on immediately? And we've got a few conversations ongoing just now. And sponsors around that are looking in what I think is an intelligent way. The second one is another company I'm involved in that is involved in preventing injuries. I won't name it because this isn't a commercial thing. But basically, it's an AI technology that allows you to see when a player or an athlete is about to get injured. Showing that to some sponsors, they've really thought that was a very interesting way for them to not just be on a shirt or be around on a billboard, but be able to say, we are sponsoring your club and we think through this technology and this innovation, we are going to be able to put more of your favourite players on the field on a Saturday. And I think they will get the return on the kind of like what I call the sponsorship variation of the corporate social responsibility report. So that's where I think sponsorship goes, being seen as the nice guy through something like this.
But hang on,
I just want to follow up on that because you started that out. It's very interesting to me what you called Liverpool, right? You called them a brand. You didn't call them a club. You didn't call them a team. You called them a brand. And that thinking, I think that's, in a nutshell, that's the difference between the corporate side and the fan side. Nobody who puts a scarf around their neck thinks of Liverpool as a brand. And the other side of the argument, on the corporate side, they do. They think of it as a brand, and they try and work out, okay, based on what we know about how we grow a brand and build a brand, what do we need to do to grow this brand? The fans don't think like that. Liverpool is never going to be a brand to them. It's going to be a piece of their heart and soul. And so no matter what happens when this comes back, the first time you start thinking about clubs as a brand instead of the renewed kind of sense of community that I suspect you're going to find from the ground up, that disparity between the corporate side and the fan side, how they think of these things, is going to grow wider.
That's really interesting to me. I agree with what you say. Clubs aren't brands. Clubs are clubs. And that's where the passion is, and that's where the value of sport comes in, the fact that they're not corporate entities. And the trouble is that most sponsors are corporate entities and act like corporate entities, and therefore don't really get the hearts and souls of the fans because they don't get they don't think like clubs. They're different. And this is the opportunity in the global sponsorship world right now, is those corporations who think and act like fans and are brave enough to do so. And that's why I've said in previous podcasts, I think I talked about the beer brands who've always been quite good at it. If you're prepared to think like the fan, act like the fan, and engage with the fan in their language, not your language. And I'm just looking at a tub of Marmite now, right? That is a brand. But Marmite is also a loved brand or hated brand, depending on yeah, right. the marketing. But it's part of our world if you're British and you like Marmite, right? You know it. And it's an emotional connection, because what a brand is what people say about your business or company when you've left the room. And that, to me, is so valuable right now in sport, where if you are a football club or a rugby club or a cricket club or whatever it is, and you've got the balls to put your brand name and next to it, and then start talking in the language of the fan. In terms of what you were talking about, Grant, is, well, how do you make money? Well, if you start to demonstrate real support and love for those yep. things you've invested in, I believe people will buy your product.
Not because you've thrown it down their throat. It's because they want to.
You've identified with them. Exactly.
You see, Grant, I take your point exactly, and nobody more than me lived that whole "it's the product, it's not the product" terminology battle. And that's what I think it is. I think it is an element of terminology, because there is no way in any definition in the world that Liverpool Football Club is not a brand. They just don't call it that. You know, whether you see the banners of Shankly and Paisley and the Kop, you know, whether it's the song. You know the song. All of those are brand architecture tools and corporate. It is a brand. It's just not called that. So that's just a communications task that a good sponsor can take ownership of and make the bridge for value, which I think they haven't done before, because it's all been about awareness or hospitality tickets or, you know, how do I get people to click back onto my betting site. I think proper brands that really want to say, remember how well you felt in the middle of the lockdown and how close you felt to everything that you loved. I'm going to remind you of that every day of your life now. And I think you will reap the rewards of that for decades if you do that well.
Yeah, it's a good point. It's something that occurred to me. I stumbled across, thankfully, in the first days of quarantine, I stumbled across the YouTube channel of the Masters Golf Tournament. And for any golfers out there, just go on YouTube, go to the Masters. They have every single final round broadcast in its entirety up on YouTube. And you can watch going back to 1968, I think it is. So you can sit and watch Sunday at the Masters from start to finish, every shot all the commercials cut out. Back in the early days, the broadcasts were a couple of hours long because they didn't show any of the front nine.
Yep.
The later ones are 4 hours long. It's fantastic. Going back and watching that, it's just theatre. You forget how many incredible moments there are, and you forget the level of drama when you just remember who won the green jacket in a particular year. But what was interesting to me, a couple of things were interesting to me. First of all, as back as recently as 1986, when Jack won his sixth Masters, which was, you know, one for the ages. It's a truly extraordinary 2 hours of theatre. But the commentators back then, they had Gary Player in the Butler cabin with Brent Musburger chatting about this. And it was really interesting how at that time, even then, the commentators were talking to Gary Player about, well, what do you think about all these foreigners winning, you know, being in contention? There's a lot of foreigners in contention. And they were called foreigners, which just struck me at the time as thinking, well, how out of place that is. But given the nature of this conversation, you know, are we going back there? I don't know. But the point I want to make with regards to what we've just been talking about is that the Masters is one of, if not the most spectacular commercial success in the world of sport in terms of the money they make, the profit they generate, their brand all around the world, whatever you want to call it. But you go back and watch the Masters in 1986 and you watch the Masters in 2018, apart from the quality of the coverage, the quality of the high definition pictures versus what it was back in 1986, and, you know, the hokey graphics and all that kind of stuff, it's absolutely extraordinary. It's the same product.
Yep.
It hasn't changed. It hasn't morphed. The course has changed, but you'd never know it. You know, they've moved the tees back. They've done this and that. It's the same product, and it has been for 50 years. But they've still managed to grow that into a commercial juggernaut around the world in every part of the globe without changing the product one tiny bit. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, and I would agree with that, and I would think that the other event that's sort of managed to do that as well would be the All England and Wimbledon tennis, where it retains
the great
tradition of playing in white and being sort of the Britain's sort of premier international, I would imagine, international sporting event. And yet at the same time, it's embraced technology, they've embraced all sorts of things, but it's still a wonderful day out at the tennis. And I agree with you. I think all of these things that we're talking about now, whether you're a sponsor, investor, whether you're a rights holder, thinking about how is it that we can find a way forward in this brave new world? And actually, what we've all said, what you distill it down to, the most simple thing, which is the fan, and creating something, an experience for the fan, whether it be the live sport, whether it be what surrounds the event, that is there for the sport. And therefore the fan. And if the fan then buys that, you have a future.
Yeah, Giles, you're right on that. And you know, I think we ourselves then have to think in our own little humble way what we're trying to do here for the fan. And what do I mean by that? Because I don't know whether you've noticed, all of you, but there's been a lot of sports organisations that when they have their rights removed from them, and these days are kind of like flapping around drowning because they don't know what to do. And there are other organizations, I've been a part of them in recent years, sports content businesses, startups, where you don't have rights, obviously you can't afford them, and you use creativity to do strange things around content. You know, and examples of that would be a bar stool or a kind of like House of Highlights or something like that. And you see these people here more ready for this shutdown. And I find that very interesting, you know, that some people are like trained and ripped for a world like this today, and others just don't know where to start. So what I want to ask us is, you know, what are we trying to do here now, especially in the months that are coming up where, you know, there isn't going to be any live sport? You know, have we got a purpose? Do people want to hear us? Do we need to change the format of the shows? What do you think, guys?
Roger, it's a great question. You know, the surprising data point that I've seen, I think it was you that shared it with me, is that people are listening to podcasts less in lockdown, which is interesting to me. I mean, I guess it makes sense, but it just tells you how much of the listening gets done on people's commute as opposed to sitting around the house listening to it. So it definitely is something that people need to think about. Is less content the way forward? Have we reached kind of peak content? And it may be that if the changes we've talked about happen in terms of from the social side of things, that there is less time spent immersed in our own world of content and more time spent, you know, with family. I mean, maybe that would be a tremendous thing to come out of this.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think that to keep challenging the world of sport, as this show has been doing for a while, and looking at the world of sport, must continue. I'm much more interested as well as understanding what listeners, what they think of the show, and being encouraged to, as we do, but to encourage people more to come in and tell us what they want to discuss. Maybe there will be the odd listener who we want to bring on and bring people on to listen to their point of view, because we're all doing this for the love of sport, but also for the future of
sport.
Certainly
not for money, Giles.
That's for sure. And the future of sport is up for grabs at the moment. I mean, this is the first time in any of in living memory, no human has ever gone through what this. It's unprecedented. What's happening? And yet, at the same time, what we are seeing, whilst there is no live sport, which you see on social media, you see in the newspapers, is already people are crying out for live sport, which shows how important it is at whatever level, everywhere around the world.
Yeah. You know, so I was thinking that, you know, first of all, we don't want to stop. So because we're not doing this really apart from the fact that we all get a kick out of it. So I don't think that's going to change. So when we're continuing, I think, you know, the way we should do it is to build on the diversity that we have. Most people won't know this, but, you know, Grant has been a content and media entrepreneur himself, and has set up what you would call these days an OTT, direct-to-consumer platform. He doesn't talk about it a lot, but he's got a whole lot of experience there. He also is one of the top geopolitical commentators in the world, and that's a huge bit of luck for us. He's involved in certain conversations that most of us don't ever get the luck to be involved in. So I think we should continue, and what I would like to do is take our offerings just now and put them on a more simple weekly basis. We've got the wonderful Captain's Table, which is timeless, as you always say, Captain, and will remain timeless. We've got our stupid pub talk, goal on goal, which is not for people that are easily offended, and I think that's a different pop product. We've got the interview, which I think we should not take up more time from people, and we should probably move that onto a monthly basis under the less is more type banner, because there's just a lot of, you know, people doing the rounds on podcasts and they're all saying the same things. And I think we should challenge ourselves to find guests that really are going to be saying something unique or not bother. And then there's what I think is this show here, which is what, I don't know, the name's not important, but what I'd like to call is like sport macro, sport and entertainment macro, where we talk a little bit about what you've heard in the last half hour. I think, you know, the CV of Grant and Giles allows us to do that with a lot of credibility. So that would be my kind of like weekly month publishing schedule, each of those four shows once a month.
Sounds good to me.
We've just got to find one person a month willing to maroon themselves on a boat with Giles. That may get trickier as the months go by, particularly with social distancing in effect.
Well, I think that's a fair comment. I wouldn't spend any time with me at all, but you know.
Well, I've got to say, you might want to get Leanne tested. She sounded like she had a bit of a sore throat last time I heard
her. did you see the wonderfully tone-deaf Instagram post from David Geffen?
David Geffen, good God. I mean, seriously.
You see, Giles?
I didn't know.
He's on this, I don't know, but it must be a £100 million yacht posting. I'm socially isolating myself
In the Grenadines.
In the Grenadines.
Stay healthy, everybody.
Stay healthy, everybody, on this fucking yacht.
A man in touch.
Yeah. Although but
the picture was obviously taken with a drone of the yacht, right? So it wasn't just him. But no, you have to see just how big my yacht is, right? It's not just a picture of me on the deck. You know, I could be anywhere. No. Here's how big my yacht is, and I'm socially distancing myself on it. What a tool.
What a tool.
I've got one last thing I want to ask you about, because it did catch my eye earlier in the week. And it's this headline, Premier League rivals launch bid to stop Man City playing in Europe. And it's basically all the contenders for those Champions League spots all kind of like lobbying together to make sure Man City don't get out of this in this moment where maybe UEFA is like punch drunk or maybe all bets are off. They're ganging up. You know, there's at the end of the day, a league is a competitive beast.
Well, Roger, and this is the dark side to yours and Jars' touchy feely hope about what happens.
Leave it to
after
me.
This.
At least for today, leave me with it.
Grant. No, but listen. But ultimately, it's Lord of the Flies, right?
It is.
That's the other potential outcome is Lord of the Flies,
yeah.
And God forbid we end up with that. But there is a very non-trivial chance that that's the way it goes. It's potentially one of the outcomes that we have to factor into our thinking.
Does that mean that I'm going to be Piggy and that in Lord of the Flies?
Well, I don't know, I wouldn't want to be a parrot right now because they taste like chicken, apparently.
Yeah, Leanne's not long for this world, I'm afraid.
No, she's not.
All right, gents. Well, look, that was
stuff.
That was a very enjoyable conversation. Hopefully the audience have enjoyed it as much as I certainly have. All that remains, once again, is to thank you for listening to this. Wish you all the best of health and good luck, and stay safe and stay indoors and look after your loved ones. And please follow us on Twitter. You'll find us at EntertainedR, that's the word, A-R-E. You'll find me on Twitter at TTMYGH.
You'll find me at GilesMorgan71.
And you'll find myself at RPM Como, as in the lake.
As in the lake, where he'll be for some considerable amount of time, I suspect. Gentlemen,
thanks,
always a pleasure.
Gents.
Let's do this again soon.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks
Take
a
care.
Lot.